Be the right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Welcome to episode 5 of season 2 of Be The Right Club Today podcast. Hal, how are you?
I'm good, Jamie.
Good, good. I'm excited for today's episode. We get Tim Yelverton on, who is a short game coach who used to work with the other Jamie when Jamie was back on the tour. So we're excited to talk about short game with him. And what are you looking forward to, Hal?
I'm looking forward to talking about Riviera here. Yeah. You know, that's I've got a lot of memories around Riviera. John Rahm has continued to be dominant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when the Spaniards get dominant, you know, what was that the famous, I think it's Fernandez, whatever his name was, the conqueror way back when, they said, you know, burn the ships. And when he got off, he said, burn the ships. If we go home, we go home on their ship. Well, the truth is, that's what the Spaniards do. They go down with the ship.
Yeah.
And they're hard to beat. And as you can see, John Rahm is hard to beat right now.
Yeah, he's in incredible form. And he looks fired up and determined to hold on to that. Back to number one, but to hold on to it.
The one thing you see with them is their determination.
Yeah.
You used that word. He looks determined all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's on fire the whole time to make birdies, you know, and to not make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
He gets mad at himself when he makes mistakes.
Yeah.
And
he's fired up.
He's got high expectations.
Yeah.
And he's performing he's at performing, that level right now.
I'm sure he's meeting them. Maybe not. Maybe he's still unhappy about a few things in the game. But, like, I don't know. If that was number one in the world, I'd be pretty happy. Max Homas, he's been in some form as well. He's really, the last couple of years, one of the players with one of the most tournaments the last few years.
I love his golf swing.
Yeah.
And, you know, he too has a lot of determination. The emotion that he felt when he didn't win this year,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, people were out there and he wanted to show them that he could win there. But we haven't heard the last of Max. He looks great.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
some good scores ahead.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing how he do in the majors this year and, you know, Ryder Cup.
It'll be fun watching.
Yeah,
definitely. I'm excited to see it.
For you, you've had a lot of success at Riviera, obviously. Why do the players love it so much?
That's a great question. The history, for one thing, you know, mm-hmm. every great player has played Riviera, mm-hmm. you know, and the clubhouse, the finishing hole, the variety of shots.
Yeah.
It's a different grass than we normally play, Kikuyu.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I don't know. I think the finishing holes are great.
Yeah.
And, I love the variety there. There's mm-hmm. a lot of different kinds of shots there.
Yep. Has it changed much, since when you played it?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't played it in a long time. It probably has changed quite a bit.
Yeah.
They changed the eighth hole when I won, at the PGA there, the eighth hole was a way different hole than it is now.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much more the other holes have changed. They've made it longer.
Yeah.
12 is significantly longer. That's a monster mm-hmm. of a hole now.
Yeah. Yep.
But yep. anyway.
Well, great. I had the fortune to play there for the first time in December, and I absolutely loved it. I thought the par threes were really cool.
Why did you like it?
It's just cool. Like you say, the history that's associated with it. I really like the greens are very interesting in certain runoff areas. A lot of fun. I think it was like seventh hole, I think, a huge big runoff area. So it makes the approach shots pretty tricky.
Yeah.
I like having to maybe shape it a little off the tee. There's a little bit of a mix of holes out there where I think it's 12 or 13. And also Max and Ram are hitting that cut off the left trees, but sets up for more of a draw, but it's you got to work it a little bit out there, keep it between the trees, don't we?
Yeah, you do need to work it there.
Yeah, which is a lot of fun. I can't enjoy that.
But, exactly, yeah.
But yeah, but right after the break, we'll have Tim Yelverton joining us and the other Jamie and Hal will be taking care of that interview for us. So We're looking forward to a little bit of short game chat, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Holderness & Bourne. Let's talk about their polo shirts for a second. The fit and fabrics are one of my favourites out there, but Holderness & Bourne really changed the game with the collar on their shirts. You can really spot a Holderness & Bourne collar. It has premium interfacing, sewn-in collar stays, and an English cut that is modern but not too aggressive. Ultimately, what does that all mean? It means you look more polished and more put together. A great collar can frame your face and give you great posture. A great collar also stays sharp, especially in the heat of the summer as you sweat, or maybe you're sweating over those nervy six-footers. Check them out at hbgolf.com and use code HSutton15 for 15% off your next order.
Welcome, everybody, to the episode 5 of Be the Right Club Today podcast. We've got Tim Yelverton on today, short game specialist from Old Waverly in Mississippi, and he's worked with Jamie Marshall some for quite a while, and he's a good friend of Jamie, so I'm going to let you and Tim take this over.
Awesome. Yeah, I just wanted to start off, say thanks, Tim, for giving us your time today. Awesome to have you on our podcast. So Tim and I go back quite a ways during my playing career. Tim was my short game coach. He's a phenomenal short game coach, works with a lot of the best players in the world now. And just a great guy. So, Tim, I think starting off, if you wouldn't mind, just share a little bit about your journey, you know, where it started for you, your coaching journey, and how you got to start working with some of the best players in the world.
Yeah. Hal, Jamie, both, thank you guys for having me. I played college golf at Southern Miss and then finished in 02 and had won a few events. And, you know, as like we all think, it's time to turn pro and go make a lot of money on the tour and win a bunch of trophies. And after a few years, that was not happening. I was playing okay, but I kind of got sort of an itch to start coaching, and I actually thought I wanted to be a college golf coach. So in 2006, I was the assistant coach at Southern Miss, and I did that for one season. And then Vijay Trolio, who also played at Southern Miss and real good friend of mine, he called me and asked me if I wanted to come teach at Old Waverly. And then he said, "You got a pretty good short game. Why don't you come up here and teach short game? I'll teach full swing. And then we'll never compete for lessons. We'll be a team." And, you know, 16 years later, here we are. So it's been really fun. And, you know, at first I was almost scared that I would never find enough people that would want to work on their short game. I know a lot of golfers don't take lessons to begin with, and then even fewer take putting lessons and short game lessons. So, at first I was a little nervous for sure, but it's worked out great. It's been a fun ride so far.
That's awesome. We see that a lot here. I mean, obviously we teach a lot of full swing here at the academy, but there are more and more people come in asking us about short game stuff. So we can do a little bit here indoors. But why don't we talk about a little bit about what you see in a lot of the amateurs you teach, and as far as the technique you like to teach.
Yeah, well, we'll start putting first. You know, with higher handicap players, if you will, or amateur golfers, or those that don't have as much time to play, we all know how important speed is and distance control is with putting. And then that's one of the things that you can build a good stroke indoors, without a doubt. Big fan of the putting arc and, you know, things like that, training aids. If you look at the training aids on the market today for putting improvement, not all, but almost all of them are, you know, stroke related, right? So you can build a good stroke, but then you still have to, get on the grass or some form or fashion to be able to apply it and then work on green reading and distance control. So I try to have players somewhat, calibrated, if you will, with their stroke, especially those players that are on time budgets, that work 40, 50 hours a week. I really like for those players to have their setup and their stroke work kind of done at home. So that when they do have 10 or 15 minutes after work, they can go work on some speed drills. They can do, some green reading exercises, things like that. And that way they can apply, the skills that they have, as opposed to the, you know, I think probably the worst type of practice you can have is to pull three balls out of a sleeve, drop them on the green, and then putt, 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 and then go to the next hole and putt, putt, putt. So I guess if I kind of broke it down, I would like, at first I want players working on technique and then having that sort of calibrated, and then working on applying that technique with one ball for sure, with lots of anticipation.
Yeah.
So I want to throw something in here, Tim. Do you find that a lot of people want to practice on short putts because they get a good result? They never spend enough time working on long putts, and then they wonder why they're not a good putter, because they can't figure out the speed of the greens and everything. You're not going to figure out the speed of the green on a 3-foot putt, basically. Mm-hmm. And then I had kids that would tell me constantly, well, there's too many people on the green and I can't putt at a hole. Well, we don't have to putt at a hole to find the speed of the green out. So people are so result oriented. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. I mean, I think one thing is players really want to use their practice to build confidence, which is understandable. We all do. That being said, making a lot of 3-footers or, you know, 30 putts on a chalk line or things like that, well, I'm not saying that's bad, but it's not very realistic to what they're about to go do on the golf course. So the more we can recreate an environment that we're about to go try and perform in, I think that translates better. Now, sometimes, you know, the thing about random practice is it's harder. So we have to be realistic with our expectations of what we're trying to accomplish in training that we're going to take over into that, you know, performance world of whether it's the club championship or the US Open or anything in between.
That comes down to basically structuring your practice, right? So
yeah,
I know we did this a lot, but I mean, I can ask you, do you still do this with your tour, like your elite players? Obviously they've got a training piece and transferring that training, and then it's testing themselves out, for competition, correct?
Yeah. When you and I were working together and Carlos and Jonathan Randolph and Fast, the whole crew, you know, it was always the three T's, right? We've trained, transfer, right. Test. And it's still the same. It's basically the same format, but like I mean, everybody that I give a golf lesson to, you know, I text them their plan at the end of the lesson. And that's kind of my filing system with every player I've ever given a golf lesson to. It's like at the end of the lesson, I text, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. These are the four things we're going to go through, because I really want my players, especially junior golfers, college golfers, where they're around a lot of other golfers, I want them to know what they're going to do before they get to the putting green or before they get to the golf course. I want it to be very structured and objective, and because we know we have a tendency to just do whatever everybody else is doing if we don't really know what we're going to do before we get there.
Right.
So yes, yeah. I mean, just like we did years ago, it's the same with everybody I work with.
Yeah, I think that helps a lot of the people we teach here too. How, like, these are people who work full time. You know, they don't have a lot of time, and it's so easy for all of us to get caught up and just go into the course, and then we're just like, well, what am I going to do today? We don't really know, and then they just throw a few balls on the green and just whack a few putts.
I think. Absolutely. All you got to do is go try to make a living doing this. Yeah. And pretty soon you're going to figure out I need structure and I need to know what I'm going to do when I get there. And, you know, I learned that early on, turned pro in 1981, which was a whole, you know, that's 42 years ago. And my first 6 months that I was out there, I realized that, hey, I have got to put structure in the way I do all of this.
And 100%. Yeah.
Discipline is really important. Discipline to the structure.
Yeah, Jim Gallagher was very gracious to say I was his short game instructor back in 2000, probably 9 or 10. And I mean, I was learning way more than he was learning from me. But the first few events I ever went to a tour event, the thing I noticed was what I saw everyone do on Monday, they were doing it again on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday they were doing the same thing. And they weren't the most elaborate drills by any means, but they had a process and they worked that process, and they were fine with checking boxes on Tuesday and then coming back Wednesday and checking those same boxes. And I think sometimes we want to have this discovery every time we practice, and then we're always seeking something else instead of just getting in there and working, you know, and just sweat and just check the boxes and then come back again tomorrow and do it all over again.
So I think something that's really important for everybody to hear right now is you've got to put the right people in your life in place to help you find the structure that you need. But once you've got the right people in place and you've got the structure that you need, there's no substitute for all the hard work and discipline that it's going to take to put that into practice. And that's what you see at the professional level on the PGA Tour. They've got the right people in place. They have the structure, and then they have the discipline. And those people are there to make sure that they do it, too. So isn't that what you see, Tim?
Absolutely. I mean, they've got, you know, they have a team, you know. Most guys out there now have I think everyone has a full swing coach. Most everyone has a putting short game coach. Obviously they have a caddy that's with them every shot of the day. They have some form of a body trainer, physios, something. A lot of players have stats, strategy coaches, nutritionists. I mean, it takes a village. There's no doubt about it. 'Cause at that level, I mean, just a tenth of a shot here and a tenth of a shot there is all the difference in making it to Atlanta or barely keeping your card.
So I've got a question at this point. How many guys steer you in a wrong direction, basically? I mean, when you ask a question, do they give you the complete truth or do you have to turn to the caddy to get the realistic truth? That's a tough question, I know, because I'm hitting on something. You know, we find it difficult to be honest. We want to think of ourselves being better. So I put you on the spot, Tim.
No, listen, I love that question because look, golf is so emotional, right? So it's so emotional that if we three putt the last hole, our putting is a disaster. Or if we had a great up and down, then now I'm an awesome bunker player on the last hole or whatever. So we have a very short term memory. Now, that being said, shot tracker has helped immensely with my job. I work also with Hunter Stewart, a lot of the players we work in tandem with. So he has their, you know, their scoring around the green, how they're putting inside of 10 feet, how they're putting their mid range putts, their long putts. So the more objective we can make, our feedback and our analysis, then it's easier to get in there. Now, that being said, golfers are humans, and humans are emotional, and we have a hard time. We kind of have our own narrative, if you will, of why did I shoot 71, right? And then some players really protect. If they believe they're a great ball striker, they'll protect their ball striking, and they'll blame their putting. And then some players, just the opposite. So we all kind of have this one little section of our game that we beat up, and then we have this one section of our game that we protect. So I would say almost everybody has a tendency to not necessarily manipulate, but it could be let's just say it's an emotional answer to, you know, how they're doing. So but stats are so much better on tour now. I wish the college teams are a little behind, but they're picking up. The LPGA, I wish to work with a couple ladies out there. I can't wait to – they're trying. They're close. They're closing in on it. But it's going to be nice when they get the same stats. And then, obviously, the amateur golf is – the more stats we have, the more information we have. And then the coach and the player and the team can make a better, more informed decision for sure.
I think, too, for at least the amateur players that we're teaching every day, I think expectations can play a big role, too. Like, falling right into that. So many people mm-hmm. – their expectations really don't match up with skill, or even like we'll show them what PGA Tour guys do and they're blown away what their stats are.
Yeah. And also going back to what Hal was saying earlier, you know, with like putting, you want to feel good. And so you hit a lot of short putts and you want to gain this confidence, right? I just see players' expectations, honestly, too low in practice and then too high and when it's time to in competition. They don't push themselves hard enough in practice, and then all of a sudden they go play, you know, this week they're at the Honda. You know, it's a hard golf course to begin with. The wind picks up, the greens get firmer and faster, and then like that doesn't need to be the first time it's been hard. you know, you need your practice and your prep to be hard. And you almost want, I had a basketball coach in high school. He was like, basketball practice were so difficult. But like by the end of the game, you felt like it was halftime. I mean, it right. was just a piece of cake, you know, and I think we need to kind of flip that a little bit. Some players do that well, but the majority of players make it too easy in practice, and then they have too high of expectation mm-hmm. and performance in the tournament.
Well, you mentioned emotions. That word came out several times. And in the game of golf, that's a big part of the game. And players ultimately don't want to really tell you what they're emotionally feeling all the time, where they're the weakest at. I mean, it's almost like a hidden secret, but yet mm-hmm. that's the reason why I ask about the caddy, because the caddy is with them all the time. And if they're mm-hmm. paying attention, that secret will become public to that caddy. And that's why you can sometimes get a little bit deeper to the core of the problem from the caddy than you can from the player sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. We don't like to feel vulnerable. You're right, because we feel like it's a weakness when it's not necessarily a weakness, but a lot of times it's just an opportunity where we can grow more. And that's why all these players at the top level are hiring people like me and, you know, trainers and, you know, strategy guys and whatnot is like, because they want to gain, you know, a quarter of a shot here, a quarter of a shot there, because they know what that will do for them over the course of a season. But you're right, we definitely try to protect certain areas for sure. There's no doubt about it. I mean, golfers are humans, like I said, and humans are very emotional. There's no doubt about it.
Yep.
let's segue a little bit into some wedge play, chipping around mm-hmm. the green. You know, for our listeners especially, got, you know, a lot of people trying to get better chipping, obviously get the ball up and down more often. What are some of the, when you're teaching an amateur golfer, what are some of the big flaws that you see more often than not?
Ooh, I think the most important thing in chipping is angle of attack. And I think most of the time when better players struggle, so let me say this. I would say the most important thing in chipping is contact. Because that's going to sure. give you predictable ball speed and how yep. that ball is going to launch, right? So if we understand how fast the ball is going to come out, how high or how low it's going to come out, and how much it's going to spin, then everything becomes much more predictable after that. Most higher handicap players, I'm usually honestly trying to get them to hit more down on it. They are usually, you know, the bottom of their swing's too far back. Where good players, I'm usually trying to shallow them out. The bottom of their swing's usually too far forward. So I'm always working a lot on angle of attack, where the club's starting to make contact with the ground, and then ultimately the angle that it's making contact with the ground. So those are the two things I look at a lot. Now there's a lot of different ways to make that happen. You know, I mean, you can go from setup changes to delivery changes, you know, technique, swing styles, things like that. But ultimately it all boils down to two things. Where does the club start to touch the ground, and what angle does it touch the ground? And like I said, for better players, they usually hit too far in front of it. They kind of mash the golf ball in their full swing, and that's why they hit it far and solid. And then higher handicap players tend to usually kind of hang back and throw at it a little bit and swing a little more up on the full swing, not as much down. And, you know, so it's usually not the same lesson, but I'm still trying to get them to do the same thing. And that's ultimately control the bottom of the arc in their short game
in some form or fashion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because honestly, like if a player goes out there and just hits every chip shot solid, they're going to be in you take a few outliers out of the way where they just are just completely dead and they're short sighted and they cannot get this ball up and down. They're going to chip it inside of about a 10 or 12 foot circle. And then from there, to trim that proximity down from 10 or 12 feet to 5 or 6 feet or 3 or 4 feet, then it's like, okay, let's make sure we're anticipating the lie correctly. How does the ball want to come out? What would be my optimal landing area trajectory? I always tell players all the time, you know, when we're assessing lies, the lie of the golf ball, and then the ratio of how far the ball has to fly, like our minimum force carry and then how much it can roll, those two things really set the tone for the shot. So once I've worked with a player's contact, then that's definitely the second piece that I move into is lie assessment for sure.
I think that's something that people just forget a lot of times too. Like they don't get up to their ball. They don't even think about the lie. They're just looking at what's out there. Like, what do I have to do? And they totally forget about one of the most important things was how's that ball sitting on the ground?
Yeah, that was the first thing I looked at whenever I was playing.
Yeah.
What is the lie? Because I can't make any decision before I know that.
Mm-mm. And that's one thing you can't change unless you play, obviously, if you play the ball up. But like, you can't change the lie. You can't change the ratio of the shot. So then from there, that dictates the shot we should choose. So a lot of times players choose the shot they're going to hit before they even see their ball. And that's when you really see the bad shots, the thin shots or the chunks. It's when you're really trying to do something that the lie doesn't promote. That's right. When you really struggle the most. Yeah.
Well, being here in Houston, our number one thing when people come in here, because we play off soft, tight, wet, you know, grainy grass. And everybody, absolutely. How do I chip into the grain? Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
It's the hardest shot there is. I mean, so one of the little checklists I'll have players go through is the first thing is to assess how high or how low the ball is sitting up. And then secondly, what's the resistance underneath the ball? There's a few other things, but those are the main two things. And so when a ball's sitting down and is soft underneath it, that's the hardest combination. Well, the easiest combination is when it's sitting up and firm underneath, right? So that would be the other end of the spectrum. But when that ball is sitting down, we got to swing enough down to get under it, but then we can't swing too much down that we go too far underneath it, right? Because there's no resistance. So I kind of have this little saying in Honda, being so grainy, I know you know how hard it is to chip at that course. I always tell players it's either A or B and there is no C. So like when you have that soft, wet, grainy lie, we're either going ball back and we're going to go ball first and we're going to take a divot after the ball, you know, kind of back foot stab. And we're expecting that golf ball to come out low and we're expecting it to come out fast. Or we're going to have the face more open and maybe the ball a touch more forward. And we're expecting and we're going to land the club behind the ball and we're going to commit to swinging hard. Because we know that ball is going to come out slow. I'm not saying bunker shot, but trending in that direction. Certainly a pitch shot, a rough, like similar to a rough shot. Because if you kind of straddle the fence and you go in the middle, then your loft and your speed never will match up. So you're guaranteed to hit a bad shot. So you either got to go ball back, low speed, low loft, or go ahead and open up the face, high speed, high loft, and don't hedge your bets for sure.
So one of the things that I'd like, I think it's the timing is right now. Let's talk about leading edge and bounce right now. And how often, and release is part of that, are not release. And so many poor players, they want to feel a release. How much does that play into the short game? If you're going to use the bounce, you can't release it. I don't.
Right. I think sometimes the golfing world in general, they feel like the only way they can use the bounce is if the club moves this way, right? If they throw the club head past the hands, if I don't have a vertical shaft at impact, then I can't use the bounce. And the key is not to use the bounce in those lies as much as it is to get the leading edge up. Now I know that's maybe a little bit of a play on words, but like if you just get players thinking about, okay, when I come in here, how can I get that lead edge up? Well, I mean, you can get the lead edge up and never throw the club head past your hands, right? So you can twist the face just a little open, twist that shaft just a touch, the lead edge rises, and now you're using the bounce, and you can still have a little bit of shaft length, right? I mean, there aren't many players, good players anyway, that really hit the golf ball with a true vertical shaft. I mean, it gets vertical quickly. Right after it touches the ball a lot of times, sure. But it's still, it's still slightly leaning forward for most all shots. Now they don't turn it down, this way, right? So like one thing I work on with, let's just say it's a right-handed golfer. Like I really like to see if they have a foot joy glove. I really like seeing that FJ kind of feeling like the FJ is looking at the sky. And that's a good way to get the lead edge up out of the ground and not feeling like you still have to, like you have to throw the club head past your hands, because that is one way to use the bounce, but it's very dicey when it comes to the bottom of the swing, like we were talking about a few minutes ago. Like, where's the club going to hit the ground? What angle is it going to hit the ground? And then I think it gets less consistent the harder we start trying to throw the club head past our hands. So I prefer probably a little bit more shaft lean than I think maybe just the average person would think. But I also prefer a club face that's a little bit more open to counterbalance that. So we still have plenty of loft, and we're still using the trail edge without having to throw the club head so hard past our hands.
So in American golf, we play the ball in the air most of the time. We don't use the ground nearly as much. You know, you play in Scotland, they're using the ground all the time. I've seen this for years. The European players are better around the greens than the Americans have been, predominantly because they know how to use the ground. I think we've gone so far to the lob wedge and playing the ball up in the air. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple, you know, a couple things that have changed. I mean, tournament golf, the rough's higher, the hole locations are on the edges, the greens are firmer and faster. So in a sense, we're kind of pushed to use that more, especially if we short side ourselves. Going back to, I'm 43, when I grew up playing golf, I was playing Bilatas, you know, and so back then you would use a little bit higher loft wedge, put it back in your stance, kind of hit down on it because it'd spin a lot. You didn't have to hit it high and soft. I like to see young players, and you know, BJ would certainly echo this too. We like seeing younger golfers, you know, grow up with less loft, because then it teaches them how to properly use the loft of the club and gain loft. And then, so that'd be, I guess that's one part of my answer. Then the other part of my answer would be like, I agree with you 100%. Let's get the golf ball on the ground when we can, right? You know, so I like for players practicing ratios a lot. And, you know, Jamie could be 15 yards from the hole and I could be 15 yards from the hole. But if Jamie has a force carry of 5 yards and 10 yards to roll out, and I have a 10-yard carry and a 5-yard roll, his shot is considerably easier than mine, because we can get the ball on the ground sooner and it can roll. So if that shot's available, we need to practice that and not just rely 100% on flying lob wedge basically all the way to the hole. So I agree with your point, Hal, completely. And I like for players to practice with a little less loft to understand how they can manipulate the wedge to their advantage, for sure, as well.
So what you're saying, and I hope everybody out there is listening, that keep all options open, not have just one option, basically.
Absolutely. I mean, people ask me all the time, should I just use one club or should I chip with every club? And my answer is, like most golf instructors, you know, it depends. But like, I mean, I think about three clubs is probably kind of where I fall. I mean, we need to practice with our highest lofted wedge, whatever it may be. Some form of a gap wedge, sand wedge, 52, 54, whatever that next wedge is. And then we need a club that we consistently can keep low, maybe a 9-iron, maybe a pitching wedge, depends on the player's preference. But I don't think we have to have 5 or 6, 7 clubs that we use. There's not much that we can do with an 8-iron, we can't do with a 9-iron. Sure.
They're carrying a hybrid. And yes, that hybrid is pretty useful at times. So
hey, I saw a ton of hybrids this week, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. There were lots of hybrids out this week, 100%. And it is a good shot if you practice it. Like, just because you just need to know, like we were talking about earlier, you just need to know that initial ball speed, because it moves the ball from a launch and a spin condition that we want for those shots. We just got to be used to how's that ball going to first come off the face. And if we know that, it is a great shot to have. I agree 100%.
And what about in the bunker? Would you agree, same thing there? You got to be able to use multiple clubs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the bunker shots. Yeah, yes, for sure, multiple clubs. Everybody kind of has, there's two cutoffs. There's a cutoff at some point where we start hitting ball first. So everybody kind of has, whether they know it or not, sort of has a yardage in their mind. They're like, okay, I blast everything inside of 50 yards or 40 yards. And then after that, they start moving to, I'm going to touch the ball, then the sand. So that's one, I guess, no pun intended, line in the sand where we don't cross. And then the other one is, like, I think at some point you're like, okay, I have a stock bunker shot, and now I have sort of a high bunker shot. And you sort of know how far you can hit those with your, let's just say, 58-degree wedge. And then after that, let's say it's 20 yards. Well, somehow between 20 and 40, you've got to get the golf ball, you know, to come out faster and release more. And the easiest way to do it is to lower the loft. So, I pitching wedge, sand wedge, gap wedge, those are great. I'm a big fan of players using pitching wedges more like the blade style pitching wedge, like their sand wedge and their lob wedge and the gap wedge, more so than looking like their 9-iron. For multiple reasons, I like the sole better, and then the grooves are much more aggressive. So I really like to see players, usually it's a 46. I really like players having a 46 that looks like their sand wedge, more so than a pitching wedge that looks like their 9-iron. It's so much better around the green. Now you'll lose a couple. Yeah. I mean, you'll lose a couple yards out of the fairway. There's no doubt. Right. Just because you have better grooves, but, it's so much better to use for long bunker shots, chipping. Even if you wanted to hit one out of the rough, I mean, it's just so much more versatile around the green. Yeah.
So you used a couple of things there I want to call attention to. You use 58-degree wedge, and you use a 46-degree pitching wedge. I could never use a 60-degree sand wedge because it seemed like I could never hit it hard enough. So mm-hmm. I played a 58-degree wedge. And everybody's going to less loft. You mentioned that earlier. Y'all like less loft in some cases. But to me, 46 degrees on a pitching wedge was a must because – we use our pitching wedge more for scoring than we do anything else. So you need to get a loft that you feel like you can score with, which is what I think you were talking about.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you want your gaps right out of the fairway for sure. And I don't really like to see gaps 20 yards max between wedges, 15 preferably. And then without a doubt, a 58 is so much easier to hit out of the fairway than a 60 is. Now, right. If you have a player, now let's say you have a player maybe with a strong grip or a flex left wrist. Everybody thinks about Dustin Johnson. Obviously, he's a great player. Now, short game specifically, that 60 might be a little better for players like that around the green. But the 58 out of the fairway is so much easier than a 60 out of the fairway for any shots from, I would say, literally from 40 to 90, those shots with a 58 are much easier to control the flight. And you're not having to swing so hard and get unpredictable spin and launch angles with that 60-degree wedge, for sure. I agree.
What are the, as far as wedge play, now we're talking about it, what are the characteristics you see with, like, elite players as far as trajectory? And maybe angle of attack, how hard are they trying to hit their wedges? We see a lot of players come in here, obviously just amateur golfers trying to get better, but they're trying to hit those clubs so far, so hard, mm-hmm. at one speed, mm-hmm. right? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, I say it all the time when I see people just literally grunting, full swing, jumping out of the ground with lob wedges. I'm like, bud, you got 12 more clubs that'll go farther than that. Like, let's relax for a second, right? I mean, slow down. TrackMan really, it's been out for a while now, but they really got, I guess, maybe woke everyone up to the idea of, like, let's get this thing launching around 30, low 30s. Higher handicap players certainly have a hard time launching the golf ball low with their wedges. I mean, they really throw a lot of loft at it. And then when you throw a lot of loft at it, you have to throw a lot of speed at it. And then you just have those balls that just go straight up, straight down, where you go on a tour range or just, and you see these wedges coming out so much flatter. And then they ultimately spin more than mm-hmm. the ball that's, taken off on whatever groove, groove eight with a delivering 45 degrees aloft and it's, shooting straight up in the air.
Right.
I definitely like seeing more controlled swings, launch angles, low 30s for sure. If you start moving into your gap wedges, it's probably even a little below 30. Lob wedges, maybe just over 30. But the, you know, the, just the standard of 30 is a good baseline for players to shoot for. And then, and then I like players to sort of have three, you know, calibrated predetermined numbers they can hit in the dark. Like I want players to be able to just hit into an, absolutely. You know, just hit into a net, or like literally if you were hitting to, you know, we don't have many holes like this in the US, but if you were hitting to a blind shot where you couldn't see the flag, but you know it's 67 yards, you know, how close can you hit it to 67 without hitting, without seeing the flag? You know, our eyes and our visuals are only going to help us more. But if I, but if you can get a player to do that pretty well without seeing the flag, just think how good they're going to be when they can see the target. So yeah, I mean, with each wedge, I like three numbers. And then going back to the gapping, it's like, if you have three, then they kind of stair step one another as far as like the full sand being the three quarter gap. And so then you have different, you have same numbers, but completely different shots. As far as the launch, the spin. So, you know, you may, you know, if the flag's on the front, it might be a full sand wedge, but if it's the same number to a back flag, it might be a three quarter, you know, whatever your next wedge is.
How do you teach people those three different distances?
I'll give them, I definitely give them some flexibility on what they want to call it. And then, I mean, they can, you know, the clock system, you know, obviously everybody, you know, with Pels, has been using that terminology for a long time. If some players like body positions, as far as like maybe a shoulder, chest, hip, everyone takes it back further than they think they do, which is fine. I don't even worry with that. I just want it to be sort of an internal calibration. I want them to feel like what it, if they feel like it's their hip, but it really goes to their stomach, and then they feel like their stomach, but it really goes to their shoulder, and then their shoulder, and it really goes to their ear. That's fine. It's like I just want it internally calibrated to their feel. So clock, half, three quarter, full, body parts, anything like that is fine.
Yeah.
But they do need to have sort of a pos, you know, you get in trouble for saying the word position a lot, but like they do need to kind of have a place they're swinging to on the backswing and the forward swing, to hit, to have those sort of three predetermined shots with each wedge.
Well, Tim, this has been great. I think we packed in a lot of stuff in a short period of time here. Very informational. I hope everybody out there is paying attention, because your game makes up more than half of your shots a lot of the time.
Yeah, it does. 40% with the putter and over half once you throw that sand wedge and lob wedge in there. So
that's exactly right.
There's a lot of work there.
And we spend a lot more time working on our full swing than we do on the short game. And we can probably save more shots with the short game.
Absolutely. No doubt about it.
Thanks again for being on Be the Right Club, Be in the Right Club Today podcast. And Jamie, thank you.
And thanks, Tim.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jamie, Hal, thank you guys. Y'all have a good week and good chatting with you guys.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
All right, welcome back to the show. That was a really great interview with Tim. His incredible listen to some of that expertise talk about the short game. What was your key takeaways?
Structure.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that he talked about, and I totally agree with this, have a plan and the discipline to do what you set out to do.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't, you're going to do what everybody else is doing.
Yeah.
And he talked on about that right off the bat. And I think that was really important.
Yeah.
Well, the other things that he talked about was the loft of the clubs and launching it correctly, more, a little bit more of a lower launch, you know, under 30 degrees or right around 30 degrees launch. Most everybody with wedges are launching it a lot higher than that.
Yeah. We see a lot of guys in here taking that lob wedge and going full out at it, and that thing's coming out really vertical.
Yeah.
Hard to control. So yeah, he talks a lot about the with TrackMan, the introduction of the launch monitors. It's that 30 degree number is like an area he likes to get the launch down in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He talked about the leading edge being higher than the bounce.
Mm-hmm.
which, you know, the relationship of that to the ground, it's not so much, you know, this as it is just the way you come into the attack angle that you come into it, where the leading edge is above the bounce.
Basically. Yeah. So not much of a kind of throw of the hands, but more of your general attack angle into the ball.
Right.
Just to help get that leading edge up a little.
Right.
I love what he talked about grain. You know, here in Houston this time of year, you get that soft, soft ground, but that grainy grass. And he was like, you have to accept A or B. It's either back in your stance and that ball's coming out a little fast, or we're moving it a little more up, using more bounce, and really committing to that and not getting caught in between. So that'll help a lot of people.
Yeah. Choose something and stick with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
isn't that one of the hardest things in the game of golf, is that we make a decision and then we see it through to the finish.
Yeah.
You know, most of the time we chicken out somewhere in here.
Yeah.
And, you know, make a decision and then see if it's right.
Yeah. Commit to it.
Commit to it.
You don't want to go into anything with the indecision.
So sure. One of the things we got coming up that I wanted to talk about, I mentioned it on here a lot, building Darmore Club out west of Houston. It's really going to be a fantastic place. I know a lot of y'all haven't seen the construction process. So we're fixing to start filming some of the things that we're doing out there so that y'all can watch the construction process as we go through it. Y'all don't have any idea what, or some of you don't have any idea what goes into green construction and tee construction and why we put a bunker where we put it and the slope of the greens and everything else. So we're going to start every podcast. We're going to have 5 to 10 minutes, and you can view this on YouTube. So if you go to YouTube, Be the Right Club Today podcast on YouTube, you'll be able to see that. And I think it'll be interesting for y'all to see that.
Yeah, definitely. It's again, like I've been out there, it's a spectacular piece of property, and it'll be cool to see how it develops as we do those clips of the place. But yeah, thanks for tuning in, and we're looking forward to the next episode.